Welcome to the Exacting Clam Cephalopodcast. Exacting Clam is a new magazine of arts and ideas brought to you by Sagging Meniscus Press. I'm Kevin Phillips Royce. This episode features a wonderful short story by C.J. Spataro. It's published in our autumn edition of Exacting Clam magazine, entitled The Becoming. This story reached me on many different levels, and I'm glad to share it with you. Doug wakes to find the husk of his wife's body in the bed next to him. Like a skin sloughed off by a snake, it is translucent, hollow, the eye holes empty black sockets. When he touches the shell of her arm, the skin disintegrates, crumbles to a soft mound of fine powder. He scrambles from the bed, stumbles, clutches the nightstand for stability. Meredith? At first his voice is low, uncertain. Meredith! She isn't dead, but she has become. That's what this is. He knows the signs. Everyone knows the signs. Meredith! He can hear her. Hears something in the hall. The bedroom is flooded with early morning sunlight and unbearably bright. He closes his eyes and then opens them again. Nothing else has changed. The pictures still hang on the walls. The beige carpet is soft beneath his bare feet. Beyond the French doors, past the deck, he can hear the pounding of the surf, the squawk of the seagulls. Doug, I'm coming in. The voice is wet and garbled. Okay, he says. This is his wife, the woman with whom he spent the last 20 years building a life. He takes a deep breath and exhales. It doesn't help. Meredith, or what used to be Meredith, opens the door and slithers into the bedroom. Doug sinks to his knees, lets his head drop to the carpet as if he's in supplication to a god. But this is not supplication. Please, Doug, his wife says, look at me. He raises his head, his face damp with tears. The transformation is complete. He should be horrified. Meredith had been a beautiful woman. Glossy black hair, a luxuriant smile, green eyes with flecks of yellow and blue. Her smile was one of the things that had first attracted him. But this? He doesn't know what to do with this. He's never seen an exocephalopod this close before. Its torso glimmers blue-green in the sunlight like a rainbow trout. Instead of arms, she, and he is still thinking of her as his wife, has eight tentacles, four of which support her torso, almost like legs, and the other four higher up, where her arms used to be. The underside of the tentacles is creamy white, with row upon row of suction cups. Now her eyes are yellow, and almost cat-like. They blink at him from the gleaming dome of her body. Doug, she says again. He stands and takes a few tentative steps toward her. Meredith, he says, what happened? A curlicue of sound rumbles from her. An exocephalopod laugh? Isn't it obvious? She says. I don't understand. I know, she says. I should have told you, but I was afraid. She slides toward him. She is close enough now that she can touch him if she wants to. Afraid you'd leave. She extends one of her arms toward him. The suction cups quiver, pucker in and out, almost like breaths. He steps back toward the French doors that lead to the beach. You should have told me. You should have prepared me. He covers his face with his hands. This is cruel. You're right, she says. The odds were so slim, She extends one of her upper tentacles and caresses his face. The suction cups are velvety, soft and warm, unexpected. He places his hand over the top, and closes his eyes. This is his wife, the woman he loves. There was a time when he would have done anything for her. If he closes his eyes and concentrates on her touch, it is almost as if nothing has changed. No, that isn't true. Everything has changed, hasn't it? He does not open his eyes when he feels another soft arm touch his shoulder, nor when yet another arm encircles his waist. He gives in completely when all four arms pull him close and the smooth skin of his chest comes into contact with this new version of his wife. All of her is soft, pliable, downy. He had expected fish scales or leather. He wants to pull away and yet at the same time wants to dive deeper, to be consumed by her, it, them, whatever Meredith has become. The suction cups hold him firmly, yet tenderly. He knows he can break free, but instead he sinks completely into her velvet embrace. One of the lower tentacles slides his boxers down, brushes across his bare buttocks. His erection pushes against his wife's pillowy underbelly. He feels the sweet caress of 1,000 suction cups pulling against his skin as if Meredith is covering him with 1,000 pairs of her lips. Sea-scented musk fills the room and hangs heavy in the air. Doug moans. He feels lightheaded, like he might faint. His body convulses with pleasure, and then everything goes black.
Star Space Magazine. Science answers for everyone. The Origins of Becoming by an Exeter. February 22nd, 2022.
Comets are icy bodies in space that release gas or dust and contain carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, and other organic materials. Astronomers speculate that comets are leftovers from the material that initially formed the solar system about 4.6 billion years ago. Each year, the Earth passes through many comet tails. Until recently, scientists didn't think much of this phenomenon, other than appreciating the spectacular light show the comet debris provided to stargazers. This attitude changed drastically in December of 2016, when Earth was enveloped in a cloud of icy organic particles left in the wake of Comet 243P Eisenberg-Himmelcroft. When Gemma Eisenberg and her husband, James Himmelcroft, discovered 243P, the expectation was that this particular comet would break apart as it rounded the sun. Instead, EH-243P slingshot its way through the solar system, flying dangerously close to Earth, leaving in its wake a debris trail so vast and dense that Earth traversed it 3 times. Stargazers delighted in the almost miraculous display of falling stars visible from nearly everywhere on the globe. That delight turned to horror as reports of the earliest instances of becoming were reported in 2017. Scientists speculate that organic particles in this debris field combine with Earth's atmosphere to create an invisible catalyst that activated the dormant exocephalopod gene carried by 10% of the world's female population. While no scientific group has come to a definitive conclusion regarding the activation or origin of the gene, its discovery has changed life on Earth.
Meredith, he says from the other side of the bedroom. He's pressed himself into the corner. He's got his hands out in front of him like he's trying to keep me at bay, whatever that means. Meredith, he says again, louder this time, please. Doug? I say his name as clearly and as calmly as I can, but it comes out sounding strange, wet, somehow full of the sea. I slide closer to him. The carpet, which used to feel so soft under my bare feet, now feels rough against my new skin. "Don't be afraid," I say to him. He looks up. His eyes are wet with fear. "I'm not afraid," he says. "I don't know what I am." His eyes dart back to the bed, to the ashy pile of my former body, then to me, to my new body, my beautiful new skin that shimmers like mother of pearl in the sunlight. I reach out with the long finger of my upper tentacle. Doug closes his eyes but does not stop me. If he wants me to, I will stop. I stroke his cheek. He shudders. I'm not sure with fear or pleasure. His cheek is rough and stubbly. Oh, the way we used to caress each other. We've been married a long time, but still, he is my husband, my mate. I'm still the same inside. My voice is soft, like a wave breaking on the sand. I still love you. I can still feel love. That will never change. He sighs in my embrace, and I pull him close, feel his human want. I cover him with tentacle kisses, slide my fingers, such as they are, where they want to go. He moans against me. The room is full of musk and funk, and when my husband passes out, I know I've gone too far. We both lost control. My power to please him in this way surprises me. Gently, I lower his body to the floor, near the foot of the bed. I hope by the time he wakes that the thousands of tiny suction circles all over his skin will have faded to memory, or at least faded. I need some air. I have to think this through. I don't know my own power. I don't know who I am anymore. What I am. I extend my tentacle and unlatch the door. I slide over the deck and onto the beach. The sun glints off my skin. The smell of Doug is all over me, his humanness. I have no tear ducts. I cannot cry, so I slide into the sea. For now. Doug wakes for a second time that day. Only this time he is naked and lying on the floor near the foot of his bed. The husk of his wife's body is still there, where she had gone to sleep the night before. Now just a pile of ash. The room is dark. He must have been out for quite some time. Moonlight spills in through the French doors and the air smells faintly of seaweed and sand. Doug's vision blurs and the room spins for a moment until he is able to orient himself. His pulse throbs in his temples like he has a hangover. Meredith is gone. At least it seems that she is gone. Dear God, what has he done? He closes his eyes and eases himself up onto the corner of the bed. He rests his head in his hands. Did he have sex with that thing? That thing is his wife, he reminds himself. The fuzzy caress of those tentacles, the hint of musk that still hangs in the air. Did he black out from pleasure? Is that even possible? If the stickiness on his thighs is any indication, then perhaps the answer is yes. He needs to take a walk, clear his head. Becoming is one thing. Betrayal is another. If only she had told him she was gene positive, he wouldn't have cared. It wouldn't have made a difference. But at least he could have prepared himself. He makes his way to the bathroom and takes a hot shower. For a long time, he stares at Meredith's perfume body wash and bath sponge. The water pours over him, turning his skin pink. He flips up the lid and holds the bottle close to his face. This is what his wife used to smell like. Is he crying? Maybe. He wets the sponge and squirts the body wash on it, working up a thick, foamy lather. Then he covers himself with the coconut and jasmine-scented foam, soaping his hair, his face, his armpits, his genitals, every inch of himself until there is no place left to clean. His mind flashes back to Meredith, to the slippery softness of her skin, the sweet suctioning of her arms and legs. Had she penetrated him with her tentacles? He feels himself get hard again and shakes his head. Get dressed. Go for a walk. Find some other humans. Outside, the stars paint the sky and the moon shines in gibbous arcs against the dark sea. Doug shrugs on his jacket and heads toward town. He isn't sure what day it is anymore. How long it's been since he's eaten. Dear God, he's never been so hungry. Where is Meredith? Will she come back? Does he want her to come back? Each step in the crisp night air helps him feel a little more grounded, more like himself. Why hadn't she told him? That's what hurts the most. He'd thought they could overcome anything, but could they overcome this? In the distance, he sees the blinking lights of the Happy Town Tavern. People. He needs to see some people and eat. Maybe it is the night air, but he is ravenous. He pushes through the door of the bar and a wall of sound hits him like a rogue wave at the beach, nearly knocking him flat. The bartender waves to him and Doug steadies himself and slides into a seat near the service end of the bar. What are you drinking tonight, Doug? The bartender smiles at him. She leans forward and Doug stares right down her shirt like a teenager. He catches himself and feels the heat rise in his cheeks. She gives him a quizzical look and crosses her arms. Are you okay? She asks. Yeah, Doug exhales. I'm good, he says. Just hungry. He leans forward, runs his hands through his hair. Actually, that's not entirely true. It's been a very strange day. He focuses on the whiskey shelf behind the bartender. Jack Daniels, Crown Royal, Jim Beam, Jameson. It is true that I am very hungry. Well, then, let's get you something to eat. Doug orders a cheeseburger, medium rare, French fries, onion rings, and an IPA. The bartender pours his beer and sets a bowl of peanuts in front of him. On the house, she says. Thanks. He nods and takes a long pull of the beer. Where's the missus? I've never seen you in here by yourself. Doug drains his glass and licks his upper lip. That bad, huh? She pours him another beer without his asking for one. Did you get into a fight or something? Doug shakes his head. Nothing like that. The barback comes out and sets Doug's burger basket in front of him. He stares at it for a minute and then takes a huge bite. The meat and cheese combine in his mouth as he chews, and it is like he's never tasted food before. The same is true of the onion rings and French fries. He can't add enough ketchup. He closes his eyes and swallows, sighs deeply before he can stop himself. When he looks up at the bartender, there are tears in his eyes. This is so good, he says. We do make a mean burger here, she says. No, really, I've never tasted anything like this. You sure you're okay? Doug lowers his head and eats some more. Each bite fills him with pleasure. He glances up at the bartender. Is she concerned about something? She's looking at him strangely. What is she worried about? He jams the last bit of beef into his mouth. Can I get another one of these? He says. Jesus, this is good. The whole thing. He points to the empty spots on his plate where his food used to be. Fries, rings, everything. He drags his finger across the plate, collecting the salt and ketchup, and sticks it in his mouth. You sure you're okay? He glares at her. Can I get that burger? Yeah, sure. The bartender turns to the cash register and puts in Doug's order, then moves to the other side of the bar. He watches her nod and smile and chat with other patrons. How had he never noticed this woman before? She has an athletic build, wavy brown hair, serious brown eyes. Meredith had tried to wear her hair like that once. She called it beachy. It was supposed to look curly, but not like she'd curled it. He hadn't thought much about it at the time. He always thought that she looked great. At least, that's what he said. That's what they told each other. It's not your outside I fell in love with. It's who you are as a person. This thought rolls through his head just as the barback comes out with his second burger. The kid sets the food down in front of him and Doug begins to laugh. At first, his laughter is low and quiet. It's who you are as a person. Then it builds until he is bent over the bar, holding his sides. Tears stream down his face. I am alone in the sea. No, that's not really true. I am not alone. The sea is full of other creatures. But despite what the tabloids might report, I cannot speak to dolphins or whales. Octopi do not recognize me as one of their own. Occasionally, I will see another exocephalopod, but we don't stop and chat out here in the ocean. We don't exchange recipes or gossip about our husbands or wives. We keep on swimming. What is there to say? I miss Doug. I miss being with him, sharing our life. But now that I have become, I realize that this is what I was meant to be. My former life was incomplete in a way that I didn't know until it wasn't anymore. This is my genetic destiny, my fate. Doug will understand. He loves me. The real me, the me that hasn't changed.
Star Space Magazine. Science answers for everyone. The Origins of Becoming by Ann Exeter. February 22nd, 2022.
The most commonly held theory is that exocephalopods are alien in origin and visited Earth during the Cretaceous period. They either accidentally or intentionally commingled their DNA with that of humanoid pre-ancestors. There could be many reasons why an advanced civilization would intentionally leave behind DNA markers, one of which is to obviate extinction-level catastrophes on their own home world. Ironically, it is probably the extinction-level event that occurred here on Earth around the end of the Cretaceous period, approximately 66 million years ago, that caused the gene to become dormant for millions of years. Those who carry the gene are predominantly cisgendered females. Studies show that there are no associated markers indicated with sexual orientation. Less than 1% of the male population carries the gene. Scientists are uncertain why this is, but speculate that it is tied to chromosomal markers, since all known male carriers also have Klinefelter syndrome, XXY chromosome syndrome. While 10% of the female population carries the gene, approximately 380 million women, only about 1 in 1,000 will become. All reported cases of becoming have occurred after the onset of menses and before menopause. The phenomenon also seems to be slowing, with fewer cases being reported each year. Since 2020, the World Health Organization has recommended that all women of childbearing age be tested for the gene. There are no accurate markers to indicate whether or not someone with the gene will become. Approximately 400,000 women worldwide have transitioned since the first reported cases in 2017.
It's been a month since Doug's seen Meredith. When he goes for a swim in the mornings, he sometimes thinks he sees her long, slippery body gliding in the water beneath him. But maybe that's just wishful thinking. At night, before he falls asleep, he thinks about her the way she was. How quick she was to smile when she was happy. How she had so little patience for stupid people. Sometimes he dreams about their encounter that first morning. how he'd awakened a second time that day, covered in his own semen, with the memory of 1,000 tiny mouths all over his body. This dream usually wakes him with a shiver. He knows he's supposed to feel ashamed, but he doesn't. Not at all. He's joined a support group for men whose partners have become. Some of the men have stayed with their partners and others have not. None of them are all that happy, either with or without their partners. But there are a few who figured out a way to make it work. Doug isn't the only man whose wife has just left him without a word, nor is he the only one who's had a sexual encounter. For some of them, sex is the reason they stay. In their group sessions, Doug gravitates towards a middle-aged man named Bo. He's one of the happier men. "The point I'm trying to make," Bo says at their Monday night meeting, "is that my wife is still the same person. She's just in a different body. If I really love her, her body shouldn't make any difference." He bites his lower lip. "And it doesn't." Jack, who divorced his wife a year ago, shakes his head, his jaw tight.
"I'm so tired of hearing you say that."
His fists are balled in his lap.
"I mean, Jesus, my kids scream every time she comes to visit. They hide in the closet."
He looks desperately at the other men in the circle.
"I can't take it anymore. She's not the same."
He shakes his head, his eyes red.
"It would have been better if she died."
"You don't mean that," Bo says. "She's the mother of your children."
"No," Jack says. "She's not. She's a sea monster, a space alien. She's not the mother of my children."
"You're a bigot," Bo says. "Your children are afraid because you're afraid."
The therapist interjects, tries to defuse the situation. He directs a question to Doug, who looks at him and blinks.
"What?"
Doug says.
"Fear is a natural response," the therapist says. "There is no right or wrong way to react. It's just important to acknowledge your feelings and not to suppress them. It's okay to feel angry or hurt or love." The therapist looks around the circle and lands back on Doug. "How do you feel, Doug?"
"I miss my wife," he says. "We don't have any kids, just each other. We had a lot of plans."
The room is silent. He knows they expect him to say more, but there's nothing left to say to these men. They can't give him what he wants. He wants to talk to Meredith. She owes him that much.
Star, Space, Magazine. Science answers for everyone. The Origins of Becoming by Ann Exeter. February 22nd, 2022.
Exocephalopods are slowly gaining social acceptance. Incidences of hate crimes have significantly decreased as science and society have worked to more fully understand the phenomenon. Some exocephalopods who are already in relationships stay with their partners, while others choose to live in closed or semi-closed colonies. Physiologically, exocephalopods differ from humans in that they have 8 appendages, which are tentacle-like with opposable fingers or tips. These appendages also have saucer-shaped cups that help propel the exocephalopod both on land and in the water. Their skin is pearlescent, with undertones of blue and green, and changes hues depending on the environment and emotional state of the animal. Exocephalopods can spend extended periods of time on land. Some have been known to go for weeks at a time without saltwater immersion. Like whales, exocephalopods breathe oxygen from air, but have tremendous lung capacity, making it possible for them to be submerged underwater for hours, even days at a time. After becoming, exocephalopods retain the ability to speak and most other humanoid characteristics.
It is unclear whether or not these are human hybrid adaptations, or if this is representative of the original exocephalopod species. Scientists may never know the answers to these questions, since no fossilized records of exocephalopods have ever been found. This fact, along with several others, are the best indicators that these creatures originated off-world and are not a native species of Earth.
Doug was my beautiful man. My heart. My everything. Life wasn't perfect. When is it ever? But our life was good by modern human standards. I fucked it up so badly he'll never take me back. I'm not ready to commit to a commune or a colony. Not just yet. But I can't seem to bring myself to go back either. For now, I'll hang near the shore. There's plenty of fish and crabs to eat. Sometimes in the mornings, I see him come out for his swim. His strong limbs push through the waves, arc and glide, arc and glide. It's like music watching him swim. I dream about our old life, how his bangs used to fall into his eyes in the morning, the funny faraway look he used to get on his face sometimes when he didn't think I was looking. Nothing ever made him angry. It used to drive me crazy, his placidness. Now I've got the whole wide ocean to keep me calm, and all I want is his stupid face, his sleepy eyes, those strong arms. I should try to talk to him one last time. I owe him that much.
Six months after Meredith's becoming, she taps on the glass of the French doors leading into their bedroom. Doug sits in an armchair rereading his childhood copy of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He's tried to go back to work, but it has been impossible, so he's retired early, hoping eventually he'll be able to move on with his life. He hears the tapping and looks up from the book. Her shape appears in shadow at first, then slowly emerges, glowing faintly blue with bioluminescence. He sets his book on the table near the chair and opens the door. It isn't locked. Meredith could have just come in, but she doesn't. She glides past him into the bedroom without speaking. The sound of sea rushes in behind her as he closes the door. He sits back down and folds his hand into his lap. "I've missed you," he says. "I've missed you." Her voice is low and gravelly. Silence hangs between them for minutes, maybe a half hour. The old-fashioned clock that hangs in the hallway ticks. Outside, the surf pounds against the shore.
"I'm sorry," she says.
"I am too," he says.
"For what?"
"For being so afraid that first day. I didn't react well. I should have been more sensitive to what you were going through."
"It's not your fault. I should have told you."
"What difference would that have made, really?" Doug says.
"You had a right to know,"
Meredith says.
"You could have made a choice. You could have left."
"And then what?" He turns to look out toward the beach for a moment. "I would have loved you anyway."
"I know."
She extends her long, thin uppermost arm. The creamy suction cups underneath quiver. Doug reaches out his hand and holds the tentacle loosely in his palm.
"I was so angry at first," she says.
"Who wouldn't be?"
"No, I don't think you understand. I was angry at you. Becoming made complete sense. It was if a switch went off in my brain and suddenly the world made sense. Everything clicked into place. Everything but you."
It was if you were the one that had changed.
Meredith's voice gurgles with seawater.
I wish I had known that becoming would feel this right. Why doesn't anyone ever talk about that?
I don't know. Maybe because no one who hasn't become would believe it. Doug squeezes her tentacle, and the suction cup caresses his palm. A flutter rises inside his gut, but he brushes it aside. He shakes his head. Would you have believed it?
Probably not.
More silence hangs between them. Then she says,
I miss you.
Then come home, he says.
Are you sure?
No. He brings her tentacle to his lips and kisses it. I've never been less sure about anything in my life.
Good,
she says.
Me either.
Well, that was a story called The Becoming. It was written by C.J. Spataro. If you like what you've heard, you can become a cephalopodscriber by visiting exactingclam.com. You can also check out our web edition magazine of Exacting Clam, a new magazine of arts and ideas published by Sagging Meniscus Press. It's been a pleasure to do this story. I'm Kevin Phillips Royce, and until the next time, clam on, my friends. Clam on.